Holden looked over the command console one more time, searching for the flashing red warning light that would give him permission to go back to the cant. Everything remained a soft green. He popped open his buckles and shoved himself out of the chair. A push on the wall with one foot sent him over to the ladder, and he descended head first with gentle touches on the rungs. In the crew area, Naomi, Amos, and Shed were still strapped into their crash couches. Holden caught the ladder and swung around so that his crew didn't look upside down. They started undoing their restraints. "Okay, here's the situation. The scapulae got hold and someone left it floating next to this rock. No one is on the scope, so maybe that means it happened a while ago and they left. Naomi, you'll be driving the salvage mech, and the three of us will tether on and catch a ride down to the wreck. Shed, you stay with the mech unless we find an injured person, which seems unlikely. Amos and I will go into the ship through that hole and poke around. If we find anything even remotely booby-trap-like, we'll come back to the mech. Naomi will fly us back to the night, and we will run away. Any questions?" Amos raised one beefy hand. "Maybe we ought to be armed, Exo, in case there's piratey types still lurking aboard." Holden laughed. "Well, if there are, then their ride left without them. But if it makes you feel more comfortable, go ahead and bring a gun." If the big, burly earther mechanic was carrying a gun, it would make him feel better, too. But better not to say it. Let them think the guy in charge felt confident. Holden used his officer's key to open the weapon locker, and Amos took a high-caliber automatic that fired self-propelled rounds, recoilless and designed for use in zero-G. Old-fashioned slug throwers were more reliable, but in null gravity they were also maneuvering thrusters. A traditional handgun would impart enough thrust to achieve escape velocity from a rock the size of CA-2216862. The crew drifted down to the cargo bay, where the egg-shaped, spider-legged open cage of Naomi's mech waited. Each of the four legs had a manipulator claw at the end and a variety of cutting and welding tools built into it. The back pair could grip onto a ship's hull or other structure for leverage, and the front two could be used to make repairs or chop salvage into portable pieces. "Hats on," Holden said, and the crew helped each other put on and secure their helmets. Everyone checked their own suit and then someone else's. When the cargo doors opened, it would be too late to make sure they were buttoned up right. While Naomi climbed into her mech, Amos, Holden, and Shed secured their suit tethers to the cockpit's metal cage. Naomi checked the mech, and then hit the switch to cycle the cargo bay's atmosphere and open the doors. Sound inside Holden's suit faded to just the hiss of air and the faint static of the radio. The air had a slight medicine smell. Naomi went first, taking the mech down toward the asteroid's surface on small jets of compressed nitrogen, the crew trailing her on 3-meter-long tethers. As they flew, Holden looked back up at the night, a blocky gray wedge with a drive cone stuck on the wider end. Like everything else humans built for space travel, it was designed to be efficient, not pretty. That always made Holden a little sad. There should be room for aesthetics, even out here. The night seemed to drift away from him, getting smaller and smaller while he didn't move. The illusion vanished when he turned around to look at the asteroid and felt they were hurtling toward it. He opened a channel to Naomi, but she was humming to herself as she flew, which meant she, at least, wasn't worried. He didn't say anything, but he left the channel open to listen to her hum. Up close, the scapulae didn't look all that bad. Other than the gaping hole in its flank, it didn't have any damage. It clearly hadn't hit the asteroid. It had just been left close enough that the microgravity had slowly reeled it in. As they approached, he snapped pictures with his suit helmet and transmitted them to the Canterbury. Naomi brought them to a stop, hovering 3 meters above the hole in the scapulae's side. Amos whistled across the general suit channel. "That wasn't a torpedo did this, Exo. This was a breaching charge. See how the metal's bent in all around the edges? That's shaped charges stuck right on her hull, Amos said. In addition to being a fine mechanic, Amos was the one who used explosive surgery to crack open the icebergs floating around Saturn and turn them into more manageable chunks. Another reason to have him on the night. So, Holden said, our friends here on the Scopuli stop, let someone climb onto their hull and plant a breaching charge, and then crack them open and let all the air out. Does that make sense to anyone? Nope, Naomi said. It doesn't. Still want to go inside? If you see anything out there that seems off, don't play hero again. Just pack up the toys and come home. But what could he have expected? Of course the Scopuli wasn't up and running. Of course something had gone wrong. Off would have been not seeing anything strange. Amos, Holden said, keep that gun out just in case. Naomi, can you make us a bigger hole? And be careful, if anything looks wrong, back us off. Naomi brought the mech in closer. Nitrogen blasts no more than a white breath on a cold night. The mech's welding torch blazed to life, red hot, then white, then blue. In silence, the mech's arms unfurled, an insectal movement, and Naomi started cutting. Holden and Amos dropped to the ship's surface, clamping on with magnetic boots. He could feel the vibration in his feet when Naomi pulled a length of hull free. A moment later, the torch turned off, and Naomi blasted the fresh edges of the hull with the mech's fire suppression gear to cool them. Holden gave Amos the thumbs up and dropped himself, very slowly, into the Scopuli. The breaching charge had been placed almost exactly amidships, blasting a hole into the galley. When Holden landed and his boots grabbed onto the galley wall, he could feel flash-frozen bits of food crunch under them. There were no bodies in sight. Come on in, Amos. No crew visible yet, Holden called over the suitcom. He moved off to the side, and a moment later Amos dropped in, gun clutched in his right hand and a powerful light in his left. The white beam played across the walls of the destroyed galley. Which way first, Exo? Amos asked. Holden tapped on his thigh with one hand and thought. Engineering. I want to know why the reactor's offline. They took the crew ladder, climbing along it toward the aft of the ship. All the pressure doors between decks were open, which was a bad sign. They should all be closed by default, and certainly if the atmosphere loss alarm had sounded. If they were open, that meant there were no decks with atmosphere left in the ship, which meant no survivors. Not a surprise, but it still felt like a defeat. They passed through the small ship quickly, pausing in the machine shop. Expensive engine parts and tools were still in place. Guess it wasn't robbery, Amos said. Holden didn't say, then what was it? But the question hung between them anyway. The engine room was neat as a pin, cold and dead. Holden waited while Amos looked it over, spending at least 10 minutes just floating around the reactor. Someone went through the shutdown procedures, Amos said. The reactor wasn't killed by the blast, it was turned off afterward. No damage that I can see. Don't make sense. If everyone is dead from the attack, who shut it down? And if it's pirates, why not take the ship? She'll still fly. And before they turned off the power, they went through and opened every interior pressure door on the ship. Emptied out the air. I guess they wanted to make sure no one was hiding, Holden said. Okay, let's head back up to Ops and see if we can crack the computer core. Maybe it can tell us what happened. They floated back toward the bow along the crew ladder and up to the Ops deck. It, too, was undamaged and empty. The lack of bodies was starting to bother Holden more than the presence of them would have. He floated over to the main computer console and hit a few keys to see if it might still be running on backup power. It wasn't. Amos, start cutting the core out. We'll take it with us. I'm going to check comm, see if I can find that beacon. Amos moved to the computer and started taking out tools and sticking them to the bulkhead next to it. He began a profanity-laced mumble as he worked. It wasn't nearly as charming as Naomi's humming, so Holden turned off his link to Amos while he moved to the communications console. It was as dead as the rest of the ship. He found the ship's beacon. No one had activated it. Something else had called them. Holden moved back, frowning. He looked through the space, searching for something out of place. There, on the deck beneath the comm operator's console, a small black box, not connected to anything else. His heart took a long pause between beats. He called out to Amos, "Does that look like a bomb to you?" Amos ignored him. Holden turned his radio link back on. "Amos, does that look like a bomb to you?" He pointed at the box on the deck. Amos left his work on the computer and floated over to look. Then, in a move that made Holden's throat close, grabbed the box off the deck and held it up. "Nope. It's a transmitter, see?" He held it up in front of Holden's helmet. "It's just got a battery taped to it. What's it doing there?" "It's the beacon we followed." "Jesus. The ship's beacon never even turned on. Someone made a fake one out of that transmitter and hooked it up to a battery," Holden said quietly, still fighting his panic. "Why would they do that, Exo? That don't make no kind of sense." "It would if there's something about this transmitter that's different from standard," Holden said. "Like?" "Like if it had a second signal trigger to go when someone found it," Holden said, then switched to the general suit channel. "Okay, boys and girls, we've found something weird and we're out of here. Everyone back to the night, and be very careful when you—" His radio crackled to life on the outside channel, McDowell's voice filling his helmet. "Jim, we may have a problem out here." Chapter 4. Miller. Miller was halfway through his evening meal when the system in his hold chirped. He glanced at the sending code. The Blue Frog. It was a port bar catering to the constant extra million non-citizens of Ceres that advertised itself as a near-exact replica of a famous Earth bar in Mumbai, only with licensed prostitutes and legal drugs. Miller took another forkful of fungal beans and vat-grown rice and debated whether to accept connection. "Should have seen this one coming," he thought. "What?" he asked. A screen popped open. Hassini, the assistant manager, was a dark-skinned man with eyes the color of ice. The near smirk on his face was the result of nerve damage. Miller had done him a favor when Hassini had had the poor judgment to take pity on an unlicensed prostitute. Since then, security detective and portside barman had traded favors. The unofficial gray economics of civilization. "Your partner's here again," Hassini said over the pulse and wail of Bhangra music. "I think he's having a bad night. Should I keep serving him?" "Yeah," Miller said. "Keep him happy for... give me 20 minutes. "He doesn't want to be kept happy. He very much wants a reason to get unhappy." "Make it hard to find. I'll be there." Hassini nodded, smirking his damaged smirk, and dropped the connection. Miller looked at his half-eaten meal, sighed, and shoved the remains into the recycling bin. He pulled on a clean shirt, then hesitated. The Blue Frog was always warmer than he liked, and he hated wearing a jacket. Instead, he put a compact plastic pistol in his ankle holster. Not as fast a draw, but if it got that far, he was screwed anyway. Ceres at night was indistinguishable from Ceres in the daytime. There had been a move, back when the station first opened, to dim and brighten the lights through the traditional human 24-hour cycle, mimicking the spin of Earth. The affectation had lasted 4 months before the council killed it. On duty, Miller would have taken an electric cart down the wide tunnels and down to the port levels. He was tempted, even though he was off duty, but a deep-seated superstition stopped him. If he took the cart, he was going as a cop, and the tubes ran just fine. Miller walked to the nearest station, checked the status, and sat on the low stone bench. A man about Miller's age and a girl no more than 3 came in a minute later and sat across from him. The girl's talk was as fast and meaningless as a leaking seal, and her father responded with grunts and nods at more or less appropriate moments. Miller and the new man nodded to each other. The girl tugged at her father's sleeve, demanding his attention. Miller looked at her. Dark eyes, pale hair, smooth skin. She was already too tall to be mistaken for an Earth child, her limbs longer and thinner. Her skin had the pink flush of Belter babies, which came with the pharmaceutical cocktail that assured that their muscles and bones would grow strong. Miller saw the father notice his attention. Miller smiled and nodded toward the kid. "How old?" he asked. 2 1/2, the father said. "Good age." The father shrugged, but he smiled. "Kids?" he asked. "No," Miller said. "But I've got a divorce about that old." They chuckled together as if it was funny. In his imagination, Candace crossed her arms and looked away. The soft, oil and ozone-scented breeze announced the tube's arrival. Miller let father and child go first, then chose a different compartment. The tube cars were round, built to fit into the evacuated passages. There were no windows. The only view would have been stone humming by 3 centimeters from the car. Instead, broad screens advertised entertainment feeds or commented on inner-planet political scandals or offered the chance to gamble away a week's pay at casinos so wonderful that your life would seem richer for the experience. Miller let the bright, empty colors dance and ignored their content. Mentally, he was holding up his problem, turning it one way and then the other, not even looking for an answer. It was a simple mental exercise. Look at the facts without judgment. Havelock was an Earther. Havelock was in a portside bar again and looking for a fight. Havelock was his partner. Statement after statement, fact after fact, facet after facet. He didn't try to put them in order or make some kind of narrative out of them. That would all come later. Now it was enough to wash the day's cases out of his head and get ready for the immediate situation. By the time the tube reached his station, he felt centered. Like he was walking on his whole foot, was how he'd described it, back when he had anyone to describe it to. The Blue Frog was crowded, the barn heat of bodies adding to the fake Mumbai temperature and artificial air pollution. Lights glittered and flashed in seizure-inducing display. Tables curved and undulated, the backlight making them seem darker than merely black. Music moved through the air with a physical presence, each beat a little concussion. Hassini, standing in a clot of steroid-enhanced bouncers and underdressed serving girls, caught Miller's eyes and nodded toward the back. Miller didn't acknowledge anything. He just turned and made his way through the crowd. Port bars were always volatile. Miller was careful not to bump into anyone if he could help it. When he had to choose, he'd run into Belters before inner-planet types, women before men. His face was a constant, mild apology. Havelock was sitting alone, with one thick hand wrapping a fluted glass. When Miller sat down beside him, Havelock turned toward him, ready to take offense, nostrils flared and eyes wide. Then the surprise registered. Then something like sullen shame. "Miller," he said. In the tunnels outside, he would have been shouting. Here it was barely enough to carry as far as Miller's chair. "What are you doing here?" "Nothing much to do with the hole," Miller said. "Thought I'd come pick a fight." "Good night for it," Havelock said. It was true. Even in the bars that catered to interplanet types, the mix was rarely better than one Earther or Martian in 10. Squinting out at the crowd, Miller saw that the short, stocky men and women were nearer a third.
"Ship come in?" he asked.
"Yeah."
"EMCN?"
he asked. The Earth-Mars Coalition Navy often passed through Ceres on its way to Saturn, Jupiter, and the stations of the Belt, but Miller hadn't been paying enough attention to the relative position of the planets to know where the orbits all stood. Havelock shook his head.
"Corporate security rotating out of Eros," he said. "Protogen, I think."
A serving girl appeared at Miller's side, tattoos gliding over her skin, her teeth glowing in the black light. Miller took the drink she offered him, though he hadn't ordered. Soda water.
"You know," Miller said, leaning close enough to Havelock that even his normal conversational voice would reach the man, "it doesn't matter how many of their asses you kick, Shadid's still not going to like you."
Havelock snapped to stare at Miller, the anger in his eyes barely covering the shame and hurt.
"It's true," Miller said.
Havelock rose, lurching to his feet, and headed for the door. He was trying to stomp, but in the Ceres' spin gravity and his inebriated state, he misjudged. It looked like he was hopping. Miller, glass in hand, slid through the crowd in Havelock's wake, calming with a smile and a shrug the affronted faces that his partner left behind him. The common tunnels down near the port had a layer of grime and grease to them that air scrubbers and astringent cleaners could never quite master. Havelock walked out, shoulders hunched, mouth tight, rage radiating from him like heat. But the doors of the Blue Frog closed behind them, the seal cutting off the music like someone hitting mute. The worst of the danger had passed.
"I'm not drunk,"
Havelock said, his voice too loud.
"Didn't say you were."
"And you," Havelock said, turning and stabbing an accusing finger at Miller's chest. "You are not my nanny."
"Also true."
They walked together for maybe a quarter of a kilometer. The bright LED signs beckoned. Brothels and shooting galleries, coffee bars and poetry clubs, casinos and show fights. The air smelled like piss and old food. Havelock began to slow, his shoulders coming down from around his ears.
"I worked homicide in Tarrytown," Havelock said. "I did 3 years vice at L5. Do you have any idea what that was like? They were shipping kids out of there, and I'm one of three guys that stopped it. I'm a good cop."
"Yes, you are."
"I'm damn good."
"You are."
They walked past a noodle bar, a coffin hotel, a public terminal, its displays running a free news feed. "Communication problems plague Phoebe Science Station. New Andreas K game net $6 billion in 4 hours. No deal in Mars, Belt Titanium contract." The screens glowed in Havelock's eyes, but he was staring past them.
"I'm a damn good cop," he said again.
Then a moment later,
"So what the hell?"
"It's not about you," Miller said.
"People look at you, they don't see Dmitri Havelock, good cop. They see Earth."
"That's crap. I was 8 years in the orbitals and on Mars before I ever shipped out here. I worked on Earth maybe 6 months total."
"Earth, Mars, they're not that different," Miller said.
"Try telling that to a Martian," Havelock said with a bitter laugh. "They'll kick your ass for you."
"I didn't mean... Look, I'm sure there are all kinds of differences. Earth hates Mars for having a better fleet. Mars hates Earth for having a bigger one. Maybe soccer's better in full G, maybe it's worse, I don't know. I'm just saying anyone this far out from the sun, they don't care. From this distance, you can cover Earth and Mars with one thumb. And
I don't belong," Havelock said.
The door of the noodle bar behind them opened, and four belters in gray-green uniforms came out. One of them wore the split circle of the OPA on his sleeve. Miller tensed, but the belters didn't come toward them.
and Havelock didn't notice them. Near miss. I knew, Havelock said, when I took the Star Helix contract, I knew I'd have to work to fit in. I thought it'd be the same as anywhere, you know? You go, you get your chops busted for a while, then when they say you can take it, they treat you like one of the team. It's not like that here. It's not, Miller said. Havelock shook his head, spat, and stared at the fluted glass in his hand. I think we just stole some glasses from the Blue Frog, Havelock said. We're also in a public corridor with unsealed alcohol, Miller said. Well, you are, anyway. Mine's soda water. Havelock chuckled, but there was despair in the sound. When Havelock spoke again, his voice was only rueful. You think I'm coming down here picking fights with people from the inner planet so that Shadid and Ramachandra and all the rest of them will think better of me? It occurred to me. You're wrong, Havelock said. Okay, Miller said. He knew he wasn't. Havelock raised his fluted glass. Take these back? He asked. How about Distinguished Hyacinth? Miller countered. I'll buy. The Distinguished Hyacinth Lounge was up three levels, far enough that foot traffic from the port levels was minimal, and it was a cop bar. Mostly Star Helix security, but some of the minor corporate forces, Protogen, Pinkwater, a la Beak, hung out there too. Miller was more than half certain that his partner's latest breakdown had been averted, but if he was wrong, better to keep it in the family. The decor was pure belt. Old-style ship's folding tables and chairs set into the wall and ceiling, as if the gravity might shut off at any moment. Snake plant and devil's ivy, staples of first-generation air recycling, decorated the wall and freestanding columns. The music was soft enough to talk over, loud enough to keep private conversations private. The first owner, Javier Lio, was a structural engineer from Tycho who'd come out during the big spin and liked Ceres enough to stay. His grandchildren ran it now. Javier III was standing behind the bar, talking with half of the vice and exploitation team. Miller led the way to a back table, nodding to the men and women he knew as he passed. While he'd been careful and diplomatic at the Blue Frog, he chose a bluff masculinity here. It was just as much a pose. So, Havelock said as Javier's daughter Kate, a fourth generation for the same bar, left the table, Blue Frog glasses on her tray. What is this super-secret private investigation Shadid put you on? Or is the lowly earther not supposed to know? Is that what got to you? Miller asked. It's nothing. Some shareholders misplaced their daughter and want me to track her down, ship her home. It's a bullshit case. Sounds more like their backyard, Havelock said, nodding toward the V&E crowd. Kid's not a minor, Miller said. It's a kidnap job. And you're good with that? Miller sat back. The ivy above them waved. Havelock waited, and Miller had the uncomfortable sense that a table had just been turned. It's my job, Miller said. Yeah, but we're talking about an adult here, right? It's not like she couldn't go back home if she wanted to be there. But instead, her parents get security to take her home whether she wants to go or not. That's not law enforcement anymore. It's not even station security. It's just dysfunctional families playing power games. Miller remembered the thin girl beside her racing pinnace, her broad smile. I told you it was a bullshit case, Miller said. Kate Leo returned to the table with a local beer and a glass of whiskey on her tray. Miller was glad for the distraction. The beer was his, light and rich and just the faintest bit bitter. An ecology based on yeasts and fermentation meant subtle brews. Havelock was nursing his whiskey. Miller took it as a sign that he was giving up on his bender. Nothing like being around the boys from the office to take the charm out of losing control. Hey, Miller! Havelock! A familiar voice said. Yevgeny Cobb from Homicide. Miller waved him over, and the conversation turned to the Homicide's bragging about the resolution of a particularly ugly case.
3 months' work figuring out where the toxins came from, ending with the corpse's wife awarded the full insurance settlement and a gray market whore deported back to Eros. By the end of the night, Havelock was laughing and trading jokes along with the rest of them. If there was occasionally a narrowed glance or a subtle dig, he took it in stride. Miller was on his way up to the bar for another round when his terminal chimed. And then, slowly throughout the bar, 50 other chimes sounded. Miller felt his belly knot as he and every other security agent in the place pulled out their terminals. Captain Shadid was on the broadcast screen. Her eyes were bleary and filled with banked rage. She was the very picture of a woman of power wakened early from sleep. "Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "whatever you're doing, drop it and go to your stations for emergency orders. We have a situation." 10 minutes ago, an unencrypted, signed message came in from the rough direction of Saturn. "We haven't confirmed it is true, but the signature matches the keys on record. I've put a hold on it, but we can assume some asshole's going to put it on the network and the shit should hit the fan about 5 minutes after that. If you're in earshot of a civilian, turn off now. For the rest of you, here's what we're up against." Shadid moved to one side, tapping her system interface. The screen went black. A moment later, a man's face and shoulders appeared. He was in an orange vacuum suit with the helmet off. An Earther, maybe in his early 30s. Pale skin, blue eyes, dark, short-cropped hair. Even before the man opened his mouth, Miller saw the signs of shock and rage in his eyes and the way he held his head forward. "My name," the man said, "is James Holden." Chapter 5. Holden. 10 minutes at 2G, and Holden's head was already starting to ache. But McDowell had called them home at all haste. The Canterbury was warming up its massive drive. Holden didn't want to miss his ride. "Jim, we may have a problem out here. Talk to me. Becca found something, and it is sufficiently weird to make my balls creep up. We're getting the hell out of here." "Alex, how long?" Holden asked for the third time in 10 minutes. "We're over an hour out. Want to go on the juice?" Alex said. Going on the juice was pilot speak for a high-G burn that would knock an unmedicated human unconscious. The juice was the cocktail of drugs the pilot's chair would inject into him to keep him conscious, alert, and hopefully stroke-free when his body weighed 500 kilos. Holden had used the juice on multiple occasions in the Navy, and coming down afterward was unpleasant. "Not unless we have to," he said. "What kind of weird?" "Becca, link him up. Jim, I want you to see what we're seeing." Holden tongued a painkiller tab from his suit's helmet and reran Becca's sensor feed for the fifth time. The spot in space lay about 200,000 kilometers from the Canterbury. As the Cant had scanned it, the readout showed a fluctuation, the gray-black false color gradually developing a warm border. It was a small temperature climb, less than 2 degrees. Holden was amazed Becca had even spotted it. He reminded himself to give her a glowing review the next time she was up for promotion. "Where did that come from?" Holden asked. "No idea. It's just a spot faintly warmer than the background," Becca said. "I'd say it was a cloud of gas because we get no radar return from it, but there aren't supposed to be any gas clouds out here. I mean, where would it come from?" "Jim, any chance the scopuli killed the ship that killed it? Could it be a vapor cloud from a destroyed ship?" McDowell asked. "I don't think so, sir. The scopuli is totally unarmed. The hole in her side came from breaching charges, not torpedo fire, so I don't think they even fought back. It might be where the scopuli vented, but... or maybe not. Come back to the barn, Jim. Do it now." "Naomi, what slowly gets hotter that gives no radar or radar return when you scan it?" "Wild ass guess here," Holden said. "Naomi said, giving herself time to think. Anything that was absorbing the energy from the sensor package wouldn't give a return, but it might get hotter when it shed the absorbed energy. The infrared monitor on the sensor console next to Holden's chair flared like the sun. Alex swore loudly over the general comm.
"Are you seeing that?" he said.
Holden ignored him and opened a channel to McDowell.
"Captain, we just got a massive IR spike," Holden said.
For long seconds, there was no reply. When McDowell came on the channel, his voice was tight. Holden had never heard the old man sound afraid before.
"Jim, a ship just appeared in that warm spot. It's radiating heat like a bastard," McDowell said. "Where the hell did that thing come from?"
Holden started to answer, but then heard Becca's voice coming faintly through the captain's headset.
"No idea, sir, but it's smaller than its heat signature. Radar shows frigate-sized," she said.
"With what?" McDowell said.
"Invisibility? Magical wormhole teleportation?"
"Sir," Holden said, "Naomi was speculating that the heat we picked up might have come from energy-absorbing materials, stealth materials, which means that ship was hiding on purpose, which means its intentions are not good."
As if an answer, six new objects appeared on his radar, glowing yellow icons appearing and immediately shifting to orange as the system marked their acceleration. On the Canterbury, Becca yelled out,
"Fast movers! We have six new high-speed contacts on a collision course."
"Jesus H. Christ on a pogo stick, did that ship just fire a spread of torpedoes at us?" McDowell said.
"They're trying to slap us down?"
"Yes, sir," Becca said.
"Time to contact."
"Just under 8 minutes, sir," she replied.
McDowell cursed under his breath.
"We've got pirates, Jim."
"What do you need from us?"
Holden said, trying to sound calm and professional.
"I need you to get off the radio and let my crew work."
"You're an hour out at best. The torpedoes are 8 minutes. McDowell out," the captain said,
his comm clicking off and leaving Holden listening to the faint hiss of static. The general comm exploded with voices. Alex demanding to go on the juice and race the torpedoes to the cant, Naomi chattering about missile jamming strategies, Amos cursing at the stealth ship and questioning the parenting of its crew. Shed was the only quiet one.
"Everyone shut up!" Holden yelled into his headset.
The ship fell into shocked silence.
"Alex, plot the fastest course to the cant that won't kill us. Let me know when you have it. Naomi, set up a three-way channel with Becca, you, and me. We'll help however we can. Amos, keep cussing, but turn your mic off."
He waited. The clock ticked toward impact.
"Link is up," Naomi said.
Holden could hear two distinct sets of background noise over the comm channel.
"Becca, this is Jim. I've got Naomi on this channel, too. Tell us what we can do to help. Naomi was talking about jamming techniques."
"I'm doing everything I know to do," Becca said, her voice astonishingly calm.
"They're pinning us with a targeting laser. I'm broadcasting garbage to scramble it, but they've got really, really good shit. If we were any closer, that targeting laser would be burning a hole in our hull."
"What about physical chaff?" Naomi asked. "Can you drop snow?"
While Naomi and Becca talked, Jim opened a private channel to Ade.
"Hey, this is Jim. I have Alex working on a fast burn solution so we can get there before..."
"Before the missiles turn us into a flying brick? Good idea. Taken by pirates isn't something you want to miss," Ade said.
He could hear the fear behind the mocking tone.
"Ade, please, I want to say something."
"Jim, what do you think?"
Naomi said on the other channel.
Holden cursed. To cover, he said,
About which thing?"
"Using the night to try and draw those missiles," Naomi said.
"Can we do that?"
he asked.
"Maybe. Were you listening at all?"
Something happened here, drew my attention for a minute. Tell me again," Holden said.
"We try to match the frequency of the light scatter coming off the cant and broadcast it with our comm array. Maybe the torpedoes will think we're the target instead," Naomi said, like she was speaking to a child.
"And then they come blow us up?"
"I'm thinking we run away while pulling the torpedoes toward us, Then, when we get them far enough past the cant, we kill the Comarae and try to hide behind the asteroid, Naomi said.
Won't work, Holden said with a sigh.
They follow the targeting laser scatter for general guidance, but they also take telescope shots of the target on acquisition.
They'll take one look at us and know we aren't their target.
Isn't it worth a shot? Even if we manage it, torpedoes designed to disable the cant would make us into a greasy stretch of vacuum.
All right, Naomi said. What else have we got?
Nothing. Very smart boys in the naval labs have already thought of everything we're going to think of in the next 8 minutes, Holden said. Saying it out loud meant admitting it to himself.
Then what are we doing here, Jim? Naomi asked.
7 minutes, Becca said, her voice still eerily calm.
Let's get there. Maybe we can get some people off the ship after it's hit. Help with damage control, Holden said.
Alex, got that plot figured out?
Roger that, XO. Bleeding G, burn and flip laid in. Angled approach course so our torch won't burn a hole in the cant.
Time to rock and roll?
Alex replied.
Yeah, Naomi, get your people strapped in for high G, Holden said, then opened up a channel to Captain McDowell.
Captain, we're coming in hot. Try to survive and we'll have the night on station for pickup or to help with damage control.
Roger, McDowell said, and killed the line.
Holden opened up his channel to Ade again.
Ade, we're going to burn hard so I won't be talking, but leave this channel open for me, okay? Tell me what's happening.
Hell, hum. Humming is nice. I just really need to hear you're all right.
Okay, Jim, Ade said.
She didn't hum, but she left the channel open. He could hear her breathing.
Alex began the countdown over the general comm. Holden checked the straps on his crash couch and palmed the button that started the juice. A dozen needles stuck into his back through membranes in his suit. His heart shuddered, and chemical bands of iron gripped his brain. His spine went dead cold, and his face flushed like a radiation burn. He pounded a fist into the arm of the crash couch. He hated this part, but the next one was worse. On the general comm, Alex whooped as the drugs hit his system. Below decks, the others were getting the drugs that kept them from dying, but kept them sedated through the worst of it.
Alex said,
One.
And Holden weighed 500 kilos. The nerves at the back of his eye socket screamed at the massive load of his eyeballs. His testicles crushed themselves against his thighs. He concentrated on not swallowing his tongue. Around him, the ship creaked and groaned. There was a disconcerting bang from below decks, but nothing on his panel went red. The Knight's torch drive could deliver a lot of thrust, but at the cost of a prodigious fuel burn rate. But if they could save the cant, it wouldn't matter. Over the blood pounding in his ears, Holden could hear Ade's gentle breathing and the click of her keyboard. He wished he could just go to sleep to that sound. But the juice was singing and burning in his blood. He was more awake than he'd ever been.
Yes, sir, Ade said over the comm.
It took Holden a second to realize she was talking to McDowell. He turned up the volume to hear what the captain was saying.
The main's online, full power.
We're fully loaded, sir. If we try to burn that hard, we'll tear the drive right off the mounts, Ade replied.
McDowell must have asked her to fire up the Epstein.
Mr. Tacumbo, McDowell said, we have 4 minutes. If you break it, I won't bill you.
Yes, sir.
Bringing mains online, setting for maximum burn, Ade said.
And in the background, Holden could hear the high G warning klaxon. There was a louder clicking as Ade strapped herself in.
Mains online in 3, 2, 1, execute, Ade said.
The Canterbury groaned so loud Holden had to turn the comm volume down. It moaned and shrieked like a banshee for several seconds, and then there was a shattering crash. He pulled up the exterior visual, fighting against the G-induced blackout at the edge of his vision. The Canterbury was in one piece.
Ade, what the hell was that?
McDowell said, his speech slurred.
The drive tearing a strut. Mains are offline, sir,
Ade replied, not saying exactly like I said would happen.
What did that buy us? McDowell asked.
Not much. The torpedoes are now at over 40 clicks a second and accelerating. We're down to maneuvering thrusters, Ade said.
Shit, McDowell said.
They're going to hit us, sir, Ade said.
Jim, McDowell said, his voice suddenly loud over the direct channel he'd opened. We're going down, and there's no way around it. Click twice to acknowledge.
Jim clicked his radio twice.
Okay, so now we need to think about surviving after the hit. If they're looking to cripple us before boarding, they'll take out our drive and our comm array. Becca's been broadcasting an SOS ever since the torpedoes were fired, but I'd like you to keep yelling if we stop. If they know you're out there, they are less likely to toss everyone out an airlock. Witnesses, you know, McDowell said.
Jim clicked twice again.
Turn around, Jim. Hide behind that asteroid. Call for help. Order.
Jim clicked twice, then signaled all stop to Alex. In an instant, the giant sitting on his chest disappeared, replaced by weightlessness. The sudden transition would have made him throw up if his veins hadn't been coursing with anti-nausea drugs.
What's up? Alex said.
New job, Holden said, teeth chattering from the juice. We're calling for help and negotiating a release of prisoners once the bad guys have the cant. Burn back to that asteroid, since it's the closest we can get to cover.
Roger that, boss, Alex said.
He added in a lower voice, I'd kill for a couple of tubes or a nice keel-mounted railgun right now.
I hear you.
Wake up the kids downstairs.
Let them sleep.
Roger that, Alex said, then clicked off. Before the heavy G started up again, Holden turned on the night's SOS. The channel to Ade was still open, and now that McDowell was off the line, you could hear her breathing again. He turned the volume all the way up and lay back in the straps, waiting to be crushed. Alex didn't disappoint him.
1 minute, Ade said, her voice loud enough to distort through his helmet speakers.
Holden didn't turn the volume down. Her voice was admirably calm as she called out the impact countdown.
30 seconds.
Holden wanted desperately to talk, to say something comforting, to make ludicrous and untrue assertions of love. The giant standing on his chest just laughed with the deep rumble of their fusion torch.
10 seconds.
Get ready to kill the reactor and play dead after the torpedoes hit. If we're not a threat, they won't hit us again, McDowell said.
5, Ade said. 4, 3, 2, 1.
The Canterbury shuddered, and the monitor went white. Ade took one sharp intake of breath, which cut off as the radio broke up. The static squeal almost ruptured Holden's eardrums. He chinned the volume down and clicked his radio at Alex. The thrust suddenly dropped to a tolerable 2G, and all the ship's sensors flared into overload. A brilliant light poured through the small airlock porthole.
Report, Alex, report, what happened? Holden yelled.
My God, they nuked her. They nuked the cant, Alex said, his voice low and dazed.
What's her status? Give me a report on the Canterbury. I have zero sensors down here, everything's just gone white.
There was a long pause. Then Alex said,
I have zero sensors up here too, boss, but I can give you a status on the cant. I can see her.
See her? From here?
Yeah. She's a cloud of vapor the size of Olympus Mons.
She's gone, boss.
She's gone.
That can't be right, Holden's mind protested. That doesn't happen. Pirates don't nuke water haulers. No one wins. No one gets paid. And if you just want to murder 50 people, walking into a restaurant with a machine gun is a lot easier. He wanted to shout it, scream at Alex that he was wrong. But he had to keep it together. I'm the old man now.
All right, new mission, Alex. Now we're witnesses to murder. Get us back to that asteroid. I'll start compiling a broadcast. Wake everyone up, they need to know, Holden said. I'm rebooting the sensor package. He methodically shut down the sensors and their software, waited 2 minutes, then slowly brought them back online. His hands were shaking. He was nauseated. His body felt like he was operating his flesh from a distance, and he didn't know how much was the juice and how much was shock. The sensors came back up. Like any other ship that flew the space lanes, the night was hardened against radiation. You couldn't get anywhere near Jupiter's massive radiation belt unless you were. But Holden doubted the ship's designers had half a dozen nuclear weapons going off nearby in mind when they'd created the specs. They'd gotten lucky. Vacuum might protect them from an electromagnetic pulse, but the blast radiation could still have fried every sensor the ship had. Once the array came back up, he scanned the space where the Canterbury had been. There was nothing larger than a softball. He switched over to the ship that killed it, which was flying off sunward at a leisurely 1G. Heat bloomed in Holden's chest. He wasn't scared. Aneurysm-inducing rage made his temples pound and his fists squeeze until his tendons hurt. He flipped on the comms and aimed a tight beam at the retreating ship.
This message is to whoever ordered the destruction of the Canterbury, the civilian ice freighter that you just blew into gas.
You don't get to just fly away, you murderous son of a bitch. I don't care what your reasons are, but you just killed 50 friends of mine. You need to know who they were. I am sending to you the name and photograph of everyone who just died in that ship. Take a good look at what you did. Think about that while I work on finding out who you are. He closed the voice channel, pulled up the Canterbury's personnel files, and began transmitting the crew dossiers to the other ship.
What are you doing? Asked Naomi from behind him, not from his helmet speakers.
She was standing there with her helmet off. Sweat plastered her thick black hair to her head and neck. Her face was unreadable. Holden took off his helmet. I'm showing them the Canterbury was a real place where real people lived. People with names and families, he said, the juice making his voice less steady than he would have liked. If there's something resembling a human being giving the orders on that ship, I hope it haunts them right up to the day they put him in the recycler for murder.
I don't think they appreciate it, Naomi said, pointing at the panel behind him.
The enemy ship was now painting them with its targeting laser. Holden held his breath. No torpedoes launched. And after a few seconds, the stealth ship turned off its laser, and the engine flared as it scooted off at high G. He heard Naomi let out a shuddering breath.
So, the Canterbury's gone? Naomi asked.
Holden nodded.
Fuck me sideways, said Amos.
Amos and Shed stood together at the crew ladder. Amos's face was mottled red and white, and his big hands clenched and unclenched. Shed collapsed to his knees, slamming against the deck and the heavy 2G thrust. He didn't cry. He just looked at Holden and said,
Cameron's never gonna get that arm, I guess.
Then buried his head in his hands and shook.
Slow down, Alex. No need to run now, Holden said into the comm.
The ship slowly dropped to 1G.
What now, Captain? Naomi said, looking at him hard.
You're in charge now. Act like it.
Blowing them out of the sky would be my first choice, but since we don't have the weapons, follow them. Keep our eyes on them until we know where they're going.
Expose them to everyone, Holden replied.
Fucking A, said Amos loudly.
Amos, Naomi said over her shoulder, take Shed below and get him into a couch. If you need to, give him something to put him to sleep.
You got it, boss.
Amos put a thick arm around Shed's waist and took him below. When he was gone, Naomi turned back to Holden.
No, sir, we are not chasing that ship. We're going to call for help and then go wherever the help tells us to go.
Holden started.
Yes, you're in charge.
that makes me XO, and it's the XO's job to tell the captain when he's being an idiot.
You're being an idiot, sir.
You already tried to goad them into killing us with that broadcast, now you want to chase them? And what will you do if they let you catch them? Broadcast another emotional plea?
Naomi said, moving closer to him.
You are going to get the remaining 4 members of your crew to safety, and that's all. When we're safe, you can go on your crusade, sir.
Holden unbuckled the straps on his couch and stood up. The juice was starting to burn out, leaving his body spent and sickened. Naomi lifted her chin and didn't back up.
Glad you're with me, Naomi, he said. Go see to the crew. McDowell gave me one last order.
Naomi looked him over critically. He could see her distrust. He didn't defend himself. He just waited until she was done. She nodded at him once and climbed down the ladder to the deck below. Once she was gone, he worked methodically, putting together a broadcast package that included all the sensor data from the Canterbury and the Knight. Alex climbed down from the cockpit and sat down heavily in the next chair.
You know, Captain, I've been thinking, he said.
His voice had the same post-juice shakes as Holden's own. Holden bit back his irritation at the interruption and said,
What about?
That stealth ship.
Holden turned away from his work.
Tell me.
So I don't know any pirates that have shit like that.
Go on.
In fact, the only time I've seen tech like that was back when I was in the Navy, Alex said. We were working on ships with energy-absorbing skins and internal heat sinks. More of a strategic weapon than a tactical one. You can't hide an active drive, but if you can get into position and shut the drive down, store all your waste heat internally, you can hide yourself pretty good. Add in the energy-absorbing skin, and radar, lidar, and passive sensors don't pick you up. Plus, pretty tough to get nuclear torpedoes outside of the military.
You're saying the Martian Navy did this?
Alex took a long, shuddering breath.
If we had it, you know the Earthers were working on it too, he said.
They looked at each other across the narrow space, the implications heavier than a 10G burn.
Holden pulled the transmitter and battery they'd recovered from the scapulae out of the thigh pocket of his suit. He started pulling it apart, looking for a stamp or an insignia.
Alex watched, quiet for once. The transmitter was generic. It could have come from the radio room of any ship in the solar system. The battery was a nondescript gray block.
Alex reached out, and Holden handed it to him. Alex pried off the gray plastic cover and flipped the metal battery around in his hands. Without saying a word, he held the bottom up to Holden's face. Stamped in the black metal on the bottom of the battery was a serial number that began with the letters MCRN, Martian Congressional Republic Navy. The radio was set to broadcast on full power. The data package was ready to transmit. Holden stood in front of the camera, leaning a little forward.
My name is James Holden, he said. And my ship, the Canterbury, was just destroyed by a warship with stealth technology and what appeared to be parts stamped with Martian Navy serial numbers. Data stream to follow.
Chapter 6 Miller. The cart sped through the tunnel, siren masking the whine of motors. Behind them they left curious civilians and the scent of overheated bearings. Miller leaned forward in his seat, willing the cart to go faster. They were 3 levels and maybe 4 kilometers from the station house.
Okay, Havelock said. I'm sorry, but I'm missing something here.
What? Miller said. He meant, what are you yammering about? Havelock took it as, what are you missing?
A water hauler millions of clicks from here got vaporized. Why are we going to full alert? Our cisterns will last months without even going on rationing. There are a lot of other haulers out there. Why is this a crisis? Miller turned and looked at his partner straight on. The small, stocky build. The thick bones from a childhood in full G. Just like the asshole in the transmission. They didn't understand. If Havelock had been in this James Holden's place, he might have done the same stupid, irresponsible, idiotic bullshit. For the space of a breath, they weren't security anymore. They weren't partners. They were a belter and an earther. Miller looked away before Havelock could see the change in his eyes. "That prick Holden? The one in the broadcast?" Miller said. "He just declared war on Mars for us." The cart swerved and bobbed, its internal computer adjusting for some virtual hiccup in the traffic flow half a kilometer ahead. Havelock shifted, grabbing for the support strut. They hit a ramp up to the next level, civilians on foot making a path for them. "You grew up where the waters may be dirty, but it falls out of the sky for you," Miller said. "The air's filthy, but it's not going away if your door seals fail. It's not like that out here." "But we're not on the hauler. We don't need the ice. We aren't under threat," Havelock said. Miller sighed, rubbing his eyes with thumb and knuckle until ghosts of false color bloomed. "When I was homicide," Miller said, "there was this guy, property management specialist working a contract out of Luna. Someone burned half his skin off and dropped him out an airlock. Turned out he was responsible for maintenance on 60 holes up on level 30. Lousy neighborhood. He'd been cutting corners. Hadn't replaced the air filters in 3 months. There was mold growing in 3 of the units. And you know what we found after that?"
"What?"
Havelock asked.
"Not a goddamn thing. Because we stopped looking. Some people need to die, and he was one. And the next guy that took the job cleaned the ducting and swapped the filters on schedule. That's what it's like in the belt. Anyone who came out here and didn't put environmental systems above everything else died young. All us still out here are the ones that cared."
"Selective effect?" Havelock said. "You're seriously arguing in favor of selective effect? I never thought I'd hear that shit coming out of you."
"What's that?"
"Racist propaganda bullshit," Havelock said. "It's the one that says the difference in environment has changed the belters so much that instead of just being a bunch of skinny, obsessive compulsives, they aren't really human anymore."
"I'm not saying that," Miller said, suspecting that it was exactly what he was saying.
"It's just that belters don't take the long view when you screw with basic resources. That water was future air, propellant mass, and potables for us. We have no sense of humor about that shit."
The cart hit a ramp of metalwork grate. The lower level fell away below them. Havelock was silent.
"This Holden guy didn't say it was Mars. Just that they found a Martian battery. You think people are going to declare war?" Havelock said. "Just on the basis of this one guy's pictures of a battery?"
"The ones that wait to get the whole story aren't our problem. At least not tonight," he thought. "Once the whole story gets out, we'll see where we stand." The station house was somewhere between one half and three quarters full. Security men stood in clumps, nodding to each other, eyes narrow and jaws tight. One of the vice cops laughed at something, his amusement loud, forced, smelling of fear. Miller saw the change in Havelock as they walked across the common area to their desks. Havelock had been able to put Miller's reaction down to one man's being oversensitive. A whole room, though. A whole station house. By the time they reached their chairs, Havelock's eyes were wide. Captain Shadid came in. The bleary look was gone. Her hair was pulled back, her uniform crisp and professional. Her voice as calm as a surgeon in a battlefield hospital. She stepped up on the first desk she came to, improvising a pulpit.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "you've seen the transmission. Any questions?"
"Who let that fucking earther near a radio?" someone shouted. Miller saw Havelock laugh along with the crowd, but it didn't reach his eyes. Shadid scowled and the crowd quieted.
"Here's the situation," she said.
No way we can control this information. It was broadcast everywhere. We have 5 sites on the internal network that have been mirroring it, and we have to assume it's public knowledge starting 10 minutes ago. Our job now is to keep the rioting to a minimum and ensure station integrity around the port. Station houses 50 and 213 are helping on it too. The Port Authority has released all the ships with Interplanet Registry. That doesn't mean they're all gone. They still have to round up their crews, but it does mean they're going.
The government offices? Miller said, loud enough to carry.
Not our problem, thank God, Shadid said. They have infrastructure in place. Blast doors are already down and sealed. They've broken off from the main environmental system, so we aren't even breathing their air right now.
Well, that's a relief, Yevgeny said from the cluster of homicide detectives.
Now, the bad news, Shadid said. Miller heard the silence of 150 cops holding their breath. We've got 80 known OPA agents on the station. They're all employed and legal. And you know this is the kind of thing they've been waiting for. We have an order.